Episode 637, Should You Be Done or Have Fun with Ready Player One?
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Matt Anderson.
And I am Ben DiBono, and we are back.
We're back, everybody, with a surprise episode. Now, we had a plan for today, and we are going to still do part of that plan, but Ben arrived in my home to do the recording, and he said, I've got a new idea, and I don't know what it is.
Right. Well, we're going to talk about Ready Player One.
All right. And what you don't know is I have just... Well, maybe I should tell you this after. Well, okay, just don't react because I don't want to know your opinion on it yet. I've just reread Ready Player One just in the last week.
Okay.
So it's very fresh in my head.
Well, that's perfect.
In fact, well, to be honest, I maybe have 20 to 50 pages left.
I am also have just reread Ready Player One within the last week, and I also have 20 to 50 pages left.
Are you serious?
I'm dead serious.
So I'll tell you approximately where I am.
Okay.
Without spoiling too much. Do you remember? Well, maybe we shouldn't, because the movie's coming out. Let's not spoil.
Okay.
We can talk about it off the air. But the reason I did decide to pick it up again is the movie's right around the corner. I think it comes out in April, I want to say.
Right.
And for some reason, because I liked my first reading of this book so much, I just wanted to have one more read through of it. With no influence from the film, because I know I'll see the film eventually, whether it's in the theater or if I rent it. So I just wanted one more peer reading of this book.
Right.
How about you? What made you want to read
it? Well, I'll get to that. So I read Ready Player One about 5 years ago, and I hadn't thought much about it since then, except for getting a little bit annoyed with it. It was kind of like, you know, how I feel about Harry Potter, where my feelings about Ready Player One had kind of gotten to the point where it wasn't so much feelings annoyance at the book itself as it was the fandom surrounding the book just was getting on my nerves for a while. So that's kind of where I'd been for a while with Ready Player One. And then about a month ago, I discovered a podcast from two of the guys who have been involved with Riff Tracks. And they were doing a podcast called 372 Pages You'll Never Get Back.
Oh, really?
Where they are reading through Ready Player One and ripping on it. And I thought that might be funny.
Okay.
So I started listening to the podcast, and then I wound up going back and rereading it as I'm listening to the episodes. And I have to say, this is an atrocious book. It's an absolutely atrocious book.
Really?
Just hang on.
Okay.
From start to finish, okay? I mean, if you've never read Ready Player One, it's just a long string of bad writing and 80s references. But I have to say, some people, including yourself, Matt, are very big fans. And I want to read one review in particular for you before we really get into our discussion.
All right.
So I'm going to read one review that I found out on Goodreads that I think kind of sums up the almost nauseating love that people have for this book.
All right.
So I'll read this review. It says, I really, really love this one. It's not the best book I've read, but it's one of the most entertaining. For anyone who was born in the 70s or 80s and grew up playing video games and is a present-day geek, this book is a love letter to you and your culture. I don't know how wide its appeal would be beyond those demographics, but for those of us who fit them, it's a home run. There are plenty of things I could nitpick. A plot is pretty straightforward. A couple of the characters, especially the villains, are pretty one-dimensional. But honestly, even though I was aware of those problems throughout the entire read, I didn't care a bit. The book is so relentlessly entertaining that it more than overcomes its minor problems. If you fit the demographics I described, do yourself a favor and pick this one up now. You won't be disappointed. So that gushing review of this awful Heroes-level crap was written by none other than Ben DiBono in 2012.
Yeah.
And so part of what I want to do in this episode is I want to warn people off Ready Player One because it is an awful book, but I also need to put myself on the couch a little bit and figure out what happened because this thing is like Heroes level bad, and I gave it a gushing review 5 years ago, and I don't know what happened. I'm usually at the front end of this when it comes to ferreting out crap. And I not only missed this one, but I fell completely under its spell. So that's the goal of this episode, is to diagnose what went wrong with me and what in the world is going on with Ready Player One, for why me and others have fallen so far under its spell when it's a completely abysmal novel.
That's crazy. So I actually loaded up your Goodreads review and I took a snapshot of it because I'm guessing it's going to be gone.
No, I will preserve it for posterity's sake.
It looks like you just happened to have some interactions about this book.
Right.
On Goodreads. It looks like Michael, how did he happen to...
Well, he's probably a friend of mine on Goodreads. No, so,
yeah, he's a listener.
He probably... I think he just finished the book.
Okay.
And he went and commented on mine after he had finished it.
And you also happened to be reading it at the same time.
That's, I did.
Quite the coincidence. So, Michael, hello, here from the Sci-Fi Christian.
So, maybe let's start here. So, I obviously have had a very different experience with Ready Player One the second time through. Let's set up first what the book is about for the five people who maybe don't know. So
we're going to try to go spoiler-free because the...
I don't think
so. Yeah, you want to just go spoilers? All right, fine. Listeners, get ready because the movie's coming out
soon. This is going to be like Heroes Rant spoilers. Okay, awful.
So we're going to spoil the book and probably the movie. Movie comes out in a couple months, so you may want to hold off on this episode until then.
Okay, so the basic premise of the book is that it's set in a not-so-distant future where a trillionaire who has recently died, he's an inventor of this kind of video game virtual reality called the Oasis, and he's left a treasure hunt, and whoever finds the Easter egg, which is the prize at the end of the treasure hunt first, is going to inherit his company and control over the Oasis, and $500 billion is basically the premise. And so our hero, Wade Watts, is telling the story of how he eventually is the winner of this contest. And I have to say, it's a perfectly fine setup. I have no issues with the basic premise of the novel. I think it's quite a fun little setup that unfortunately does not pay off. Now, what has your opinion been as you've been rereading Ready Player One?
I still love it.
Really?
Yeah, because here's my initial review from May 2015. This is one of the best fiction books I've read in a long time. It was so much fun, and there were times when I just couldn't stop. I needed to know what was going to happen next. I'm not a gamer, so I was worried that I might not be able to get into the book because of that. However, this wasn't a problem for me at all. Although there is a strong video game aspect to this book, the focus on games of the 1980s, my early childhood, The focus is on games of the 1980s, my early childhood. On top of that, the books had constant 1980s pop culture references in terms of music, movies, and television. I could relate to a lot of what was being discussed. There was action, mystery, humor, and much more. I love this book. I'd say I still love this book. I mean, there's some references I still don't understand because it is from about 10 years too early.
But that's not the issue.
But I don't feel like there's any storytelling problems.
You don't think there's any storytelling problems?
I'm guessing that this episode's going to be about the storytelling problems I missed, but go ahead.
Okay, so let's start with all of these references. There are about 5 trillion references to 80s properties in this book.
Yeah, how is this going to get... I was thinking today, how much is going to get changed for the big screen where they couldn't get the rights to some of the stuff that they use in here?
Right, so... There's a first problem with this book is that the entire premise for how he's trying to draw you in is to simply list things that you know. Now, he doesn't go into any detail about what they are or why they're good or why they matter to him. It's simply a list. So this is one famous list, and I'm not going to read the whole thing because this goes on for about 2 pages, where towards the beginning of the book, he's talking about the things that he read. And he says, when it came to my research, I never took any shortcuts. Over the past 5 years, I'd worked my way down the entire recommended Gunter. A Gunter is somebody who's hunting this egg, Easter egg, reading list. Douglas Adams, Kurt Vonnegut, Neal Stephenson, Richard K. Morgan, Stephen King, Orson Scott Card, Terry Pratchett, Bester, Bradbury, Haldeman, Heinlein, Tolkien, Vance, Gibson, Gaiman, Sterling, Moorcock, Scalzi, Zelazny. It's just, this is what the entire book is. It's just throwing out lists of stuff, and then you're supposed to think, oh, I like J.R.R. Tolkien.
It's not true.
This is 100% true.
That's not true. There are lists, but the whole book is not lists.
The whole book is like this.
It's not true.
Where does he ever go into depth on the references?
Tons of times.
No.
During the gate scenes, during the finding the key scenes, during the character building moments where they're playing a game together.
What character building moments? What characters?
Like the relationship building between the characters.
Okay, let's talk about the characters for a second. Right. So this book is written essentially like fan fiction. The entire premise of the book is that you're supposed to buy into a Mary Sue character in Wade Watts. Wade Watts is good at everything instantly.
See, I thought about that also while reading this time around. But he's telling the story. It happens to be... The reason he's even telling the story is because he did happen to... I mean, of course, we're talking about fictional character here, but he did happen to achieve something that no one else could. So, yes, everything is going well for him, but that's why we're even getting the story. Because
but
there is
that's
a framing,
the exact Mary Sue premise.
There is a framing device in which we kind of, he, at the beginning of the story, the author, the narrator, already knows how the story is going to end. And, I mean, we kind of have a feeling from the beginning that everything is going to go fine.
But he is impossibly good at this stuff. Like, he has memorized whole movies.
Yeah.
He has...
Do you get what I'm saying? The reason we're even hearing his story is because of that trait.
No. That's not a trait. It's impossible.
It's different than in a story where you happen to come along somebody, they join you on your adventure, and they're super good at everything. The reason we're getting this person's story is because he is super good at everything.
But but the things that he's good at, he wouldn't have the time to do them. Yeah,
they explain that tons of times. There's
No, they don't. He's watching hundreds of episodes.
Yeah, they totally explain that. In this world, in this future, they don't do barely anything else. And while you're in... Not while you're in school, they do talk about that, but... He's talked about how he was able to put 12 or more hours per day into his research.
But if you go through this whole list of stuff that he claims he's memorized, the amount of time he's spent on it doesn't even come close to what he claims he's able to do. So the book has this huge Mary Sue problem where he is impossibly good at everything.
I think that in this case, sometimes you're right about that, but in this case, I don't think you're right. He is good at everything, but that's why we're getting the story. It's not somebody who just happens to join the story and is automatically good. You might be able to make an argument of the time thing, but that we know that the time thing's
100% true.
The contest has been going on for 5 years before we even get the start of the story. So there was a lot happening that we didn't see.
But it's not just that he watched this stuff once and then moved on. Like, he talks about how he memorized every word of War Games. He says he watched Monty Python and the Holy Grail 145 times. He watched Blade Runner.
That's a real quote.
It's 140 something.
Okay.
I guarantee it.
I mean, I did just hear something today. I think it was Excalibur, maybe the movie Excalibur, which I haven't seen. I think he said something like, I've watched this one. I don't want to, because now that we're having this argument, I don't want to just throw out a random number, but it was a number that I felt like, really? You've seen it that many
times? That's the whole way through the book. He's doing that.
So I'm saying I'll kind of agree on that point, but I don't 100% agree that it's not possible.
I guarantee you that if you go through the book, it is impossible. I mean, look at the list of authors I just read.
Somebody should, I remember the list. Somebody should count this up. Like, okay, it takes about this much time to read this book. This book will last this many, or this.
They did that on this podcast.
Oh, really?
It's nowhere close to enough.
Okay.
The math does not work, and it's not even close.
But why does that bug you?
Because it's the Mary Sue quality of that he's impossibly good at things. And
If you want to say the time doesn't make sense, that's a good argument. But I don't think you can say that this character is a Mary Sue.
Yes, he is.
In the sense that, but do you hear what I'm saying?
But the definition of a Mary Sue is somebody in fiction who is impossibly good at everything.
But he's not he isn't always perfect in this.
Oh, yes, he is.
I mean, there's times where other people are more successful than him.
But as soon as he needs a skill for the sake of the plot, he instantly has it.
That's not true. When he was seeking out the different keys, he was second place, third place, even, I think he might have even been lower for a short period of time.
True. But that he didn't need it yet in the plot. So, for example,
I believe he needed help to find certain clues.
For example, when he gets captured by the bad guys, IOI, we suddenly learn that he's an expert computer hacker on top of everything else, mm-hmm. which that hasn't come up before. It doesn't come up until he instantly needs it.
It came up when because he does customer service. IT
customer
help.
Service.
No, he does IT. Repair.
I'm an IT tech guy.
Yeah.
That and hacking into one of the most powerful companies in the world are two different things.
But
they're not the same.
He had codes to hack in. It wasn't like he created.
I know this section very well. I just read it.
I just did it too. Today he buys the codes from an auction and then uses those codes to hack in.
Okay, let's talk about the codes because this is a perfect example of where this book is messed up.
He does use skill.
It's codes to get him in, but then skill to do everything else. He's busy hacking their systems. All the codes were backdoors into their intranet.
Yeah.
He hacks everything else once he's inside.
I think it had been established that this is a guy who really understands
tech. When did he learn all of that? He's watching Monty Python 143 times.
He's naturally gifted.
And he becomes, you're not naturally gifted at hacking. You have to go learn that.
I don't know what he did, but he did.
That's not how this works.
But this character had a life before we met him, so we don't know when he learned those things.
He was 12 before we met him.
Yeah, but he lives in a world that's total technology-based. Like, it's totally different than ours.
Right.
So, everything his whole life has been online and working with computers. I can buy it.
So wait a second. You're buying that he's an expert level hacker because he worked with computers before he was 12?
I'm saying this character happens to have skills in that area.
Okay, now let's talk about the computer codes he got into auction.
He got an auction, he bought some codes.
Okay, this happens over and over again in the book where he gets in trouble and then he mentions, "Oh, by the way, years ago I bought these codes and now I'm going to use them." There's no setup with the writing. There's no setup of, like, you mentioned that he had these codes on page 20 and then he needs them on page 200. Like, that's good writing. This happens over and over again in the book.
I will agree with this particular, just this instance of that. But if you're going to say over and over, give me just a couple more.
I will give you more examples.
Okay, go ahead. So basically, I agree, because I do feel like we're debating here a little bit. I agree that came out of nowhere.
It completely comes out of nowhere.
So what else?
When he's sitting there and he finds the clue for the second gate with the Blade Runner origami, he just happens to be thinking of Blade Runner, and then he just happens to say the word unicorn and just all magically unfolds in front of him.
You know, okay, so this is another area of the book that I just listened to today.
Yes.
And when I was listening to that part, it did. I was wondering, how could anybody solve that particular riddle?
Right.
Like, what about that foil? Like, did it look identical to the Blade Runner scene? I can't even really picture that scene. So that's not exactly the same as it popped up out of nowhere. But it's more like, I don't think it was really clear how that even was connected to Blade Runner. And, like, if you look at the other characters that solved it without his help,
right?
How did they think of saying unicorn?
Well, the way that the bad guys would have solved it is just brute force everything. Like, there's a reference to a test in the clue, so just take every test that's mentioned in a property that's in the guy's almanac and just brute force it.
You know, if I was that kid, Wade Watts, since he is such a technological genius, as we've already established, I would have created some sort of program that would scan the almanac for, like, keywords, like test.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. This is part of the problem of the book, is it doesn't make any sense what he's doing.
And
his opponents are ones with unlimited resources, and they didn't manage to do that.
Okay, so tell me another thing where it popped up to help him, but it never came up before.
He's just randomly sitting, and he figures out that the first clue refers to learning, and he's on a planet about learning. Then he just happens to look up and he sees the manual for the Dungeons and Dragons Tomb of Horrors, and he realizes that that must be what the clue is talking about, and just happens to be sitting right in front of him.
Wait, how? It wasn't sitting in front of him.
He
thought about it.
No.
Why would the classroom
in front
have
of
the
him,
Tomb of Horrors?
It was sitting in front of him in his trailer the shelf in real life.
Okay.
Okay, so that's another one.
But why? If he owns it, why is that a problem? If I happen to think of the Bible, and there it is on my shelf.
Because this happens again and again, where the thing that he needs just happens to be right in front of him at the moment.
You're saying it happens to be in his
home? This is bad writing, because there's no setup that he has this, and then later it pays off. It's that it's never mentioned in all of these cases, and then all of a sudden it's right there for him.
I'm totally fine with agreeing with you when you say things that are true, but if you're saying...
But this is 100% true.
If you're saying you're mad because... something a character owned, like, we don't need his whole history of shopping and collecting things.
But there's such a thing as setup.
So you're saying at some point they should have mentioned everything he owns, so that when he needed it in the book, we could be like, oh yeah, they did mention that.
No, you don't do that. You don't,
because it's in his house.
No.
It's like his...
what I've said is that you set stuff up by, like, have him flipping through the manual, and then later on have, so you've established the fact that he owns this, and later on you pay it off. I'll give you an example of where he does it right in the book is with the Pac-Man coin. He sets that up, he gets it, he doesn't know what it means, and then later on it pays off. It's the one time that he does this well in the book.
There's another time where he does set something up. Og is invisible in the room.
Right.
Early in the book, but we kind of...
That's just creepy.
That's creepy
that there's this multi-billionaire who's invisibly watching children in their chat room.
Well, they're not all children, but yes.
That's very weird. It's a very weird thing.
He was trying to make sure that they were good guys.
Okay.
So I don't think you totally proved that point, but the one instance of the codes I can agree with.
Why don't I give you more instances?
That were not the same thing.
They're totally the same thing.
He owned something and then he looked up and it was in his own home.
Okay, this happens too with the artifacts that he's mentioning. Like, I don't remember the specifics, but at different times when he's battling the IOI guys, he'll be like, and oh, by the way, I had bought this artifact and now I'm going to use it. And the thing that he uses gets mentioned a few paragraphs before he actually uses it. There's no sense of setup.
You're just saying ambiguous.
That's Deus Ex Machina stuff.
I know, but give me a specific example.
Well, I told you I can't remember the specifics of it, but it happens within that.
That particular problem comes up as much as you think it does.
Those are like all the major points in the book so far.
Your best point so far was that he shouldn't have been able to memorize war games.
Every point in the book, like every major turning point, happens not because of his skill, but because of coincidence.
I'm pausing because I don't know if I totally agree, but I'll hear you out.
Okay, gate one. He happens to be sitting in front of the Tomb of Horrors book. Gate two, he happens to say the word unicorn and it suddenly appears. He gets captured by the IOI. He happens to have these codes that he's bought before. There's no skill involved. It's constant coincidence. It's fantasy, self-fulfillment, it's wish-fulfillment fantasy playing out that he's just naturally good at everything. And then... The movie he needs to recite is War Games, and he just happens to have memorized that one.
Well, the reason he memorized it is because it's...
Do you know how long it takes to memorize a movie?
But this is not out of nowhere. They establish... what's the guy's name? The dead rich guy's Halliday. Mm-hmm. Halliday's favorite movie is War Games. His favorite music is Rush.
Right.
His favorite video game is Black Tiger. So it's not just that he is... magically good at knowing those things. He knew those were Halliday's favorite things, and so he gave special emphasis to his study towards them.
No, if it was just those things, I would agree with you, but it's literally everything in the book that he mentions. He says that I memorized this.
It's because of the almanac.
I memorized that.
Okay, listen, listeners, in case
the almanac lists every single pop culture thing in the 80s.
Okay, listeners, in case you don't know, if you're just listening to this and you've never heard the book or read the book or seen the movie, everybody who wants to be a part of this quest gets a book called an almanac, Anorak's Almanac, and it has details about pop culture, but it also has Halliday's journal entries, and it talks about the things he likes, and so you would be stupid not to study everything in there. And so
everything in there is like a lifetime worth of stuff.
Yeah, I know, it's a ton of stuff, but you're saying it's out of nowhere that he knows how to play Joust or that he knows how to play Pac-Man or how
but then he knows
that
how
movie.
To do it all perfectly. That's the part
but
that's out of
but
nowhere.
We know he's been putting hours into practicing, and one point you've made so far that I think I can get on board with is probably if you time this out, that is not possible for him to put that many hours
okay.
in it. But
so the timing doesn't work.
For the sake of the story.
The Deus Ex Machinas don't work.
If you just believe that, okay, he had the time. I don't know how, but he had the time. Then those other things make sense. It's not that he happened to know how to play or to say all the words of War Games. In the story, he knew this was Holiday's favorite movie, so he watched it over and over to learn whatever he could learn. Or
but he did that with every movie. Like there's such a thing as suspending disbelief and just throwing it on the ground, shattering it, burying the ashes, burning and salting the earth. That's what he does with belief. It's so unrealistic.
Okay, so I keep going. Do you have any other points, or is this most of your thing you don't like about it?
No, I don't like all of it. It's so poorly written. Okay, Wade Watts is a terrible human being.
Okay, give me more about that. Why do you hate him?
He is, okay, so Wade Watts abandons his family. Instead of just giving up on this little contest, he allows them to get blown up.
Okay, hold on. It's his aunt, yes, but he's not close to her. I'm not saying he should let her get blown up. But
he lets the entire building get blown up, not just his aunt.
He does not know for a fact that they're not bluffing.
Okay, so the choices are keep playing a contest.
Or we're going to murder
your neighborhood. Or we're going to murder your aunt.
But he chooses
a video game over letting his aunt live.
He does think it's possible that this corporation may be bluffing instead of literally murdering people.
Okay.
I mean, they're not like assassins. They're a technology company.
So let's say that you're playing Mario here.
Yeah.
And you get a phone call from Target.
No, it's not Mario. It's a quest for billions of dollars.
Okay.
Okay.
Would you risk having this apartment building blown up so that you could get to the next level of Mario? And
it's
the best
comparable.
Part, no, but here's the best part of this is that it's not even that he has to quit the contest. He just has to give them the clue for how to find the next key, and they get it within minutes of him refusing to help them anyway. They get it.
Right, they do get it
instantly.
I don't think they get it instantly.
They do. I remember this very vividly. As soon as he logs back in after watching his aunt and friends and old Mrs. Germain or whatever her name is die in a fiery blaze, hundreds of dead children, he logs back in and he sees that IOI has just got the key.
Do you remember how they got it?
The brute force. They figured out that he was a student on this planet.
Oh, it's because that guy blogged about them.
Yes.
Well, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
IROC.
Right. Okay. Let's leave plot mechanics aside for a second.
I don't think we agree on this. I mean, when you complain, I can often see your points. I'm not saying this is the best book ever, but it's super enjoyable, and I don't think it's as bad as you think.
It's a pandering novel. Like, all of these references, there is no depth to any
but
of them.
What do you make of then me not, like, this is, none of this is nostalgic to me.
Some of it is.
What? Tell me something.
Well, you said in your review that you grew up in your 80s, and so this is stuff from your childhood.
No,
you said that in your review.
I said, although there's a, blah, 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 I think I was trying to say, because I was young in the 80s. The 90s are my childhood years.
Right.
So I'm telling you right now, I don't feel nostalgic towards most of these things.
Sure.
So why do you think I still enjoyed it?
I have no idea.
Why do you think why did you enjoy it the first
time? So that's the real mystery, is how did I get trapped in this? Because this is an awful book. Like, this is, the writing is bad, everything. I'll tell you how I think I got trapped in it. I think that this book is the nerd equivalent of Twilight.
Okay.
Or 50 Shades of Grey. It's a terribly written novel that zooms in on a demographic like a laser. And if you get caught in that demographic, everybody outside of it who reads the thing says, this is awful. But if you're inside that demographic and it hits you in just the right way, he is a very effective writer. I'll give him that. He's not a good writer, but he's an effective writer.
Effective in what way?
In the sense that he's able to tweak the right buttons.
Okay.
He's able to pander and push the nostalgia buttons in such a way where, like, Ben of 5 years ago wasn't as grumpy about nostalgia, and so being pandered to in this way didn't bother me, but now I'm really grumpy about nostalgia, so the book is almost unreadable.
Yeah, I do think Ernest Cline, who's the author of this book, has nerd interests like a lot of our listeners, I'm guessing, and so maybe he was just, it almost feels like a book that he would like. He wrote a book that he would like, and then it happened to also
I don't think it's not like this is a book that's a deep love letter to all of these things. It just lists them without any depth to them. Like, he just throws stuff out and says, here's a reference, you know, here's a reference, you know. Oh, my car's a DeLorean, but it also has features from Knight Rider on it. Mm-hmm. Do you like Knight Rider? Do you like Back to the Future? Then you'll like my car. Oh, my ship is a Firefly class, but I also called it the Kurt Vonnegut. So if you like Kurt Vonnegut or you like Firefly, now you'll like my ship. That's what the whole book is like. It's just nonstop spewing references in the most pandering way possible.
I was just thinking today while I was listening to this book that... the book is set in 2044, but right. Because Holiday loves the 80s, all of the references are 80s, but even the character doesn't really mention anything, because he should be familiar with everything beyond the 80s also, even if they're outside of the game, but there aren't, as far as I can remember, there aren't a lot of references beyond 80s pop culture.
There's a few, like Firefly gets name dropped a few times, but it's just, it's this constant name dropping of this and that, and this reference, and here's another Star Wars reference, and this was like a lightsaber, and I had 50 lightsabers owned by my avatar.
We must be at the exact same part of the book.
Right.
So now let's say we're at, we already said spoilers. Okay. I'm at the big final battle where all the robots are fighting.
I'm a little bit ahead of there.
Okay, so the mech Godzilla just killed a bunch of people, but I think they're figuring out how to, and they said something like, it must have to recharge.
Yes.
So that's right where I'm at.
Right. And so it's stuff like that. It's the recharge. It just conveniently at the right time has to recharge. He conveniently is able to get the information that he needs out of IOI just at the right time.
That's not convenient. That's just a mechanism. Like, I think that's
no, that's not a mechanism.
You don't think that's true to the movie also? It's a machine Godzilla. You can't just...
I don't know.
You have to follow the rules.
Maybe there's something about Mecha Godzilla that I don't know. So I'll give you that one.
Get this. In the book... Oh, sorry, in the film, I'm just looking on the website here, it looks like it's going to pay homage to pop culture references, primarily of the 80s, but also 90s, 2000s, and the 2010s.
See, it is going to be a nauseating experience to sit through this movie.
Like, how is it going? So are you going to see it?
No.
Okay, like I said, I'm not dying to see it in the theater, but I'll rent it at least.
Okay.
But what do you make of that? Guess what? Well, there's a reference to 2001 in the book, obviously.
Not really. There's a reference to...
To a line in the movie. The stars.
No, that's not a line.
Oh, it's
2010.
Okay, 2010. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. Guess what, though? References to 2001 A Space Odyssey have been identified in promotional materials for the movie.
Right.
So I'm sure you'll love that.
Well, see, this is exactly the point. This is what the book does, is it says, here's 2001 A Space Odyssey. You love 2001 A Space Odyssey. Don't you love that? And it's like, no, I'm not going to love your book just because you mentioned something else I love, right? That's the entire experience of reading this. Okay, there's one other area that we have to talk about, and that's the fact, and this is a little PG-13. I don't know how else to put this, but this book is essentially Ernest Cline's sex fantasy.
Okay.
I'm 100%. I'm not. Don't censor this out.
Okay.
I'm serious about this.
Okay.
Okay? It's incredibly perverse with the way that he goes about his character. Ernest Cline, there's a poem that he wrote, and again, this is PG-13, so to turn it off if you have kids listening. There's a poem he wrote sometime before Ready Player One, but it's available on his website, and it's about how much he loves pornography.
Okay.
And what he just... No, don't edit this out. This is a good...
I'm just saying something else. While you say points, I sometimes get ready for my next statement.
Okay. You're writing down a time code. What he describes in this perverted, bizarre poem is exactly what happens in the book, which is how much he likes geek girls who look like this. And wouldn't you know that what he's describing is exactly the way Artemis looks in the book. And so he's just enacting out his fantasy with this thing. When you realize and you read this thing and then you read the book and you realize this is just this perverse, bizarre novel that he's constructed so that he can live out his bizarre sex fantasies, and then you read passages like where he's talking about masturbation and he goes on and on for pages on this, and it's so weird and so bizarre.
On and on for pages. I mean, yeah, I'll give you that there are references, but on and on for pages.
He describes the rig in extremely graphic detail of everything that his character is doing with it.
There is stuff that is in line with what you're saying, but I don't think it's pages of the book dedicated. How about paragraphs? I'll give you paragraphs.
Okay. Well, I'm reading on Kindle, so I can't tell how many pages or paragraphs or whatever. My point is that this book is Ernest Cline's fantasy, and not just about geek stuff, but including some pretty dark places that he went to in his little poem, and it's messed up. And every main character in this book is just his own internal projection of himself, living out his own fantasy of being good at everything, of succeeding at everything, of getting to control this virtual reality oasis. It's atrocious writing.
Isn't that common, though, for a lot of writers, that they do put in their own fantasies into stories so that they get a chance to be a hero?
That's what fan fiction is. That's what Mary Sue is. That's exactly what that trope is.
So I'm just saying, I don't think that, I mean, if you, I guess I don't see a huge problem with writing out a version of a story that would be something you would love to experience. I mean, I think a lot of stories are that way. I'm not
such
saying.
Such as?
Tons of heroic stories.
Such as?
I could go on and on. Here I go. Star Wars. Like George Lucas has said, he is Luke Skywalker.
Where does he say that?
I'll find it right now.
Okay. I don't think George Lucas has said that he wrote himself into Star Wars as Luke Skywalker.
His last name is Lucas, and Luke...
Well, that doesn't mean anything.
It does mean something.
And furthermore, Luke Skywalker, there's a difference between the hero's journey that Luke Skywalker goes on and the I'm good at everything quest that Wade Watts embarks on. Huge difference.
Talk about something else, if you really want me to try to find a quote.
I don't need you to really find it.
Okay.
Well, I
think we can agree that this is definitely common in writing.
I agree that it's happened, but the way that it happens here is akin to the Mary Sue fan fiction. It's not akin to somebody saying, I'm writing out the hero's journey and putting traits of myself into that. This is every character is wish fulfillment fantasy for him. It's a projection of himself so that he can be good at everything.
Let's see.
And it's when you realize how deeply personal and twisted it is, it becomes very awkward to read.
Yeah, I feel like you just kind of want to hate this one. I'm not saying it's a 5-star read, even though I did enjoy it at a 5-star level. I just feel like you might be looking for things to hate in this case.
I don't think I'm looking for things to hate.
Like, there's times where we watch something together, and I could totally get like, yeah, I get why it's not very good, even if I like it.
I think you're blinded, just like I was 5 years ago.
Okay.
You too can see the light.
So, this is just an interesting side note. Nothing really about this conversation, but this book doesn't tend to have any, as far as I can remember. Oh, there is a Spider-Man reference, but I was going to say there's not really any superhero references in this, which right now that's the big thing in pop culture. The movie is going to include DC comic characters. Is this by Warner Brothers?
Probably.
Yes. This movie is released by Warner Brothers. So we're going to have... So Warner Brothers owns DC superheroes and also Lord of the Rings. And so both of those will be appearing in this movie. I don't see anything about this, but Warner Brothers also owns the movie rights to Harry Potter. So I would not be shocked if there's something Harry Potter in this movie.
But don't you think that's lazy to just be putting references to things that people know in there in the hopes that they'll get excited when they see them?
You know, even though you and I don't agree about the book, I've seen this trailer multiple times, and I don't think it looks that good.
Agreed.
And seeing the DeLorean, seeing different things, the Iron Giant... Well, I guess I'm not a huge Iron Giant fan, but seeing all the different things together, whereas it's weird. In the Lego movie, I kind of liked the Lego movie where there were all the
different
characters.
But they were playing it for laughs,
yeah, right,
too.
Yeah, I kind of like that, but seeing the same thing here, for some reason, didn't really click with me.
Right.
So, all that to say, I enjoyed the book. I don't necessarily know that if the movie continues down that path, but then also amplifies it because they can.
Right.
I don't know that I'm going to like that, but it doesn't seem like your biggest complaint is... all of the properties mentioned, you just don't think the writing is very good.
No, both of those are big complaints. Okay. The writing is the worst complaint, but the properties being mentioned is a huge complaint because it's the epitome of laziness. It's the epitome of being pandering. It serves no purpose other than to just list things that people know.
Man, now that we have talked so much about this, I almost feel like we have to do a movie episode about it. But
we're not going to do a movie episode about it. I'm done with Ready Player One.
And I think Ready Player One is fun. So I guess now, the title. So
I would encourage you and all the other listeners to go check out 372 Pages You'll Never Get Back Even if you like the book, it's hilarious.
Okay, so how could I find that?
372pages.com. It's right. They've got, I think, 8 episodes on Ready Player One, and now they're reading Armada.
Wait, oh, actually, I did that one too.
So I'm going to be reading Armada for the first time as I listen to this podcast.
So why is it called 372 pages? You'll never get back if they do multiple books.
Well, they only had plans to do Ready Player One at first. Okay. So that was...
So this is a podcast I can listen to.
This is a podcast. It's absolutely hilarious.
Okay.
And they shred this book for everything it's worth.
I will listen to it, at least a little of it.
You should. I think you'll enjoy it.
Yeah. All right. Great. Well.
All right.
And then
we'll come back for an episode after you listen to 10 hours of why Ready Player One is awful, and you'll be reformed.
So the funny thing about it is I feel like you and I heavily debated. A lot of times when you make your points, I can see what you're saying. In this case, I just don't see that it's as bad as you're saying. It's not my favorite book, but it is a top read for
me. I think we would have had to have gotten more into the text with specific examples, but it is atrocious. It's a train wreck. I'd recommend everyone steer clear. And for those specific examples, check out 372 pages You'll Never Get Back.
And listeners, if you have any feedback on this, you can write us at feedback@thesapphirechristian.com or call us at 612-4121-SFC. But for now, that's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
I'm Ben DiBono.
We're the Sci-Fi Christians, signing off.
I guess we kind of missed the other part of that episode, which is that I'm wrong sometimes.
Oh, wait a minute. What do you mean?
Well, I was going to lament my 5-year-old review where I praised something that didn't deserve it.
Yeah. Can you think of any other things that you liked once and then you
realized...
Well,
I can think of lots of things I liked as a kid.
But this is...
This is like...
5 years ago.
Recent, Ben.
Yeah.
So that's troubling. Like, that shows a major blind... Like, the analogy I was giving to you in the news episode of what if you went to a restaurant...
Yeah.
And everyone else was vomiting and you just loved the food.
Yeah.
Like, that just happened here. And it concerns me that I fell for Ernest Cline in Ready Player One, not just a little bit, but head over heels. Like, that's concerning to me.
I guess we could do a follow-up episode about Armada. I've read that. I'm not going to reread it.
Right. Well, maybe you will when you listen to the podcast.
I don't know. I didn't really like that one that much.
You gave it 5 stars, I think.
Armada?
I'm pretty sure.
I might have given it 4, but in 3.5, maybe.
I don't know. I looked at your Goodreads.
Let me go look. There's no way.
I have your Goodreads just about memorized.
Let me see. 5 stars. I didn't like it that much. I can remember thinking it was okay. Oh, 4.5. There, at least that's a little bit better.
But I think if you give 4.5,
that seems pretty high.
That's really high. But you should just give 4 stars in Goodreads. Like, save full 5 stars for something that's really 5 stars. But Goodreads is kind of dumb. I wish they would do half stars.
Here's a non-spoiler review of Armada.
Okay.
I really enjoyed this book. It was a lot of fun. The voice of the story is very similar to Cline's Ready Player One. However, that book is better than this one. I still like this one. It just isn't at the same level as Ready Player One. Maybe that's why I have memories of it not being that good, because I was expecting to love it the way I did Ready Player One, and it was just okay, I guess. The book falls into a rare group of books that I can't stop listening to. Wow, maybe I should re-listen to this book.
Right.
When are you going to start listening to it?
Well, I'm gonna read it.
When are you going to start reading?
Probably tomorrow, because I'm going to finish the Ready Player One episodes in the podcast.
Here's the books I ranked as... So this is April 2016. Here are the books I had recently said were books I couldn't stop listening to when I was on the audiobook.
Okay.
Ready Player One.
Yep.
The Drawing of the Three, which is a Dark Tower book. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Red Shirts. And Armada.
Oh, I don't like Red Shirts.
Hmm. Wow, I'm surprised. Maybe I should give this one a re-listen. And we could do an Armada episode.
Well, yeah. I mean, you should listen to it while you do the read-along with their podcast.
Okay.
They're very funny, and you don't have to listen to a lot. They're not mean like me. They're funny mean, whereas I'm just crush your soul mean.
You are crush your soul mean.
That's my specialty. Yeah, it's the Riff Tracks guys.
Yeah, this was almost a 5-star rating, but there were some parts during the final third of the book that seemed like the author wasn't clear on where to take the story next in order to properly wrap things up. The plot started to get a little jumbled, and I had a hard time following exactly what was happening, especially during the battle scenes.
Right. You mean Ernest Cline didn't manage to construct a coherent narrative? I'm shocked.
I mean, in my memory, this is not a 5-star read. In my memory, this is 3.5.
Right.
So, I'm surprised. You surprised me.
Well, thank you.
I can't believe you do have my Goodreads memorized.
I know you better than you know you.
You must be on it all the time. All right, well, let's just close out here.
I'm not. It's just that every now and then when I'm curious what you think about a book or a movie.
You must have just looked, though, at this one.
I looked a few days ago.
Yeah, okay, that makes
but
sense.
But no, here's what happens is I usually look at what you rated a book, and I'm so shocked by what you rated it that it sticks in my memory. Like, that's how I know that you gave Batman v Superman 4.5 stars on Letterboxd. Because that was just a shocking moment when I saw that, and I can never forget it.
All right. I'm closing this down. Goodbye, everybody. Thanks for listening, and let us know your thoughts on Ready Player One. And let us know your thoughts when the movie comes out, too, because maybe we can convince Ben to do a follow-up movie review
episode. I don't think that's going to happen.
All right. So long, folks.
Goodbye.